Welcome to the Quantum Fields and Strings course. So this course is going to be a survey-style course. We have introductions to three different topics. So this week, I'll be discussing anomalies. The next 2 weeks, Jaume will give you an introduction to conformal field theory. And the final two weeks, Davide will discuss string theory. So the topic for this week are anomalies, or quantum effects that spoil classical symmetries. Noether's theorem, one of the foundational results in theoretical physics, you've seen it discussed in many of your classes already, quantum theory and classical physics, QFT courses. It's an essential result. And I'm here today to tell you that Noether's theorem is a lie. A symmetry, at least in a sense I'll make more precise in a moment, does not necessarily imply a conservation law. In other words, a classical symmetry does not imply conservation law in the quantum theory. And there are a number of ways to see this. We've actually encountered examples before. For example, in QFT2, we looked at massless phi to the fourth theory in four dimensions, which has a classical scaling symmetry. Nevertheless, we found it had a non-zero beta function, which means that there's some scale dependence there. So we're going to try to, in this week's lectures, understand under what conditions classical symmetry leads to conservation law in the quantum theory. And along the way, we'll see that one way to think about this is that this comes from UV considerations. To define our quantum theory, or define our observables in a quantum field theory in general, we need to introduce regulators so we can make well-defined predictions for the low energy theory. So the one way to understand why this occurs is that in some cases, it's impossible to find a UV regulator that preserves a symmetry, or at least all of the symmetries simultaneously. So given this fact, you may wonder about whether or not these effects can be observed. I won't speak too much about this, but in fact, anomalies can tie together UV physics and IR physics. I'll have a little bit to say about this, but not too much. In fact, they can have, in some cases, understand the anomalies can give you a understanding of the IR physics completely. One example is pion decay. The neutral, for those of you who've taken the standard model course, you may have discussed this already, there's a neutral pion, which is a bound state of a quark and anti-quark. There's a symmetry that forbids, a symmetry of the classical theory that forbids its decay to two photons. Nevertheless, this decay is observed, and this decay rate can be predicted just by computing the anomaly. I won't have much more to say about this, but it is an important fact that it's not just, we're not just worrying about UV physics here. This has important observable, anomalies have important observable consequences in the IR. Okay. So, so classical symmetries don't always imply conservation laws in a quantum theory. Let me just briefly say a few more words about what I mean by a conservation law in the quantum theory. There are many ways to derive another theorem. I'm not going to derive it again. But let's just suppose we're interested in considering symmetries of some action for a scalar field theory. If this theory has a symmetry, that means there is some transformation we can do the fields. Let's consider an infinitesimal transformation. We do general. So here x is some functional of phi, and epsilon is some small parameter. If this is a symmetry of the theory, then the action is invariant. One way to derive the conserved current that I believe David discussed with you is to promote this parameter, which is a constant, if this is a symmetry, to a function of spacetime. If you do that, the action will no longer be invariant. You'll pick up a new term. And the new term is proportional to the divergence of the conserved current associated with this symmetry. So this is one way you can find the conserved current. Okay. Now, so in the classical theory, it's certainly true that this current is conserved. No other theorem is a theorem. It is a true statement about classical physics. What I mean by this statement is that the classical theory doesn't tell you everything about the quantum theory. Okay. So we want to consider the quantum theory. We want to consider a quantum version of this equation. One way to do that the quantum versions of conservation equations are known as Ward identities, at least in simplest cases. And one way we can derive Ward identities is by considering a functional integral, a generating functional. Okay, so I'm going to work in Euclidean space. So let's just consider partition function. So here I'm in Euclidean space, and I've set h bar to 1. Now in this functional integral, we can do a change of variables in phi. do the change of variables, phi goes to phi plus epsilon x of phi, then the action is invariant, but we can do the same thing as we did before and make this epsilon a function of space-time. So this is a change of variables. So our functional integral shouldn't change. Z should be unchanged, our partition function is the same. Nevertheless, it's instructive to consider what the expression we get if we do this change of variables and compare it to our original expression. So let's do that. So under this change of variables, that becomes integral d phi prime. Let's call this phi prime. E to the minus s, e to the minus epsilon dot d mu. So here I'm using the same notation as in QFT2 by taking the dot product of two functions. I mean, they multiply the functions and integrate them over space time. Okay. So this should be, we've just done a change of variables. So this functional integral should be equal to our original functional integral. Let's expand out the second exponential and compare terms. So this first term, the 1 multiplying this, is exactly the same as our original expression, with one difference. The measure is now d phi prime instead of d phi. If we make the assumption d phi prime is equal to d phi, then we can conclude that since this whole thing is equal to the original expression and the first term is equal, that this linear term in epsilon has to vanish. And that implies that the expectation value of d mu, j mu, is 0. So this is the quantum version of our conservation law. But note that this only follows if the measure is invariant. So this suggests one way this suggests how a classical symmetry can fail to lead to a quantum conservation law. So this is one consequence. If this is a symmetry, this is the quantum version of the conservation equation. This will not. This is only 0 if the measure is invariant. And of course, there are other correlation functions that will be 0. We can expand this out to higher order, and we'll get an infinite tower of correlation functions that would necessarily vanish. And those collectively are known as the Ward identities.
What possible reasons could make that an equality false? I mean, roughly, I'd expect it to depend on the space-time geometry.
Yes. So this So whether the measure is invariant or not will depend on the particular symmetry, as well as the particular theory that you're examining. Later, we'll see how to compute this, the change in the measure exactly. And that's a useful thing to do, because even when the current is not conserved, we can derive what's known as an anomalous non-conservation of current equation, where we get some other term on the right-hand side. And that other term contains very useful information that we could use, for example, to predict the pion decay rate. That would be all you'd need to compute the pion decay rate, or in other examples, so you can use the anomaly to make physical predictions. So we'll see how to do this tomorrow. We'll look at explicit examples. But today, I want to examine one of the simplest physical systems that exhibits this behavior. And that system is so we're going to look at the chiral symmetry in this system. We're going to look at the chiral anomaly in massless QED in two dimensions. So mass QED is much simpler in two dimensions. We only have an electric field. There's no magnetic field. There's only one degree of freedom in the electromagnetic field. Nevertheless, this theory is rich enough to exhibit this behavior. I think it's worth looking in detail at this simplest case, so we get some understanding and some physical intuition for what's going on here. So to elaborate, let's just start by looking at QED. Before we go to QED, let's just look at the fermionic part of the Lagrangian. If we take a free fermionic field, this has two symmetries. It has what's known as a vector symmetry, where we take psi to e to the I alpha psi. And it also has known as an axial or chiral symmetry. This is the vector symmetry. Axial chiral symmetry, where psi goes to e to the I alpha gamma 5 psi. So both of these are symmetries of this Lagrangian. They lead to conserved currents. The conserved currents, in this case, I'll call J mu, which is psi bar gamma mu psi. And for the chiral symmetry, I'll call the associated conserved current J mu 5, which is similar but has an extra gamma 5. So these currents are conserved. You could use Noether's theorem. I think you did this exercise in QFT1 to show that these are conserved currents. And this is also true in QED. If we add gauge field the gauge field is transforms trivially under both transformations. So these remain symmetries of QED, also other symmetries of the free fermion, also symmetries, free massless fermion, also symmetries of massless QED. And in QFT1, you looked at these symmetries in four dimensions. Basically, nothing changes in two dimensions. Except for the the specific representation of gamma 5, but basically everything else follows exactly as you've seen before. Okay, and what we're going to see is that these two symmetries conflict in the quantum theory. I'm going to argue that there's no regulator that preserves both of these theories in the quantum theory. So you would think we would have a choice between which one we want to conserve. The conservation of the vector current is connected to gauge symmetry. If we break gauge symmetry, that can have bad consequences for the consistency of the theory. So we don't have much of a choice and are forced to break the chiral symmetry if we want to preserve the gauge symmetry. So, we're going to take a rather simple approach to trying to determine how these two symmetries conflict. We can do something more sophisticated using path integrals, and we'll do that tomorrow. But today, I just want to show you that you can understand this just at the level of the spectrum. So that's all we really need to see this conflict. And it's really a deep conflict between these two. And we can see it if we compute the spectrum of this theory. And to do that, it's useful to, let's see. So we basically just need to solve for the energy levels of the fermion. So we can see this. The anomaly is present. If we quantize the fermion field, but leave the gauge field as a classical background field. So that's going to be our approach. And again, all we need to do is find the spectrum of the fermions to see that we can't possibly conserve both currents simultaneously. So we'll work in the chiral basis, which is the same as we used to in 4D. So we've got some projection operators, P plus and minus. And we can define And gamma 5 is 2 eigenvalues plus or minus 1. I can define psi plus or minus to be the positive and negative chirality fermions. So this is all the same as in four dimensions. And in this chiral basis, so let's first consider the case where we turn off our gauge field. So in this, we turn off the gauge field, our equation of motion is just I d0 plus or minus I d1. Psi plus or minus is 0. And so the solution to this equation of motion are just plane waves moving to the left or the right. Left or right. The left is plus, minus. And they're moving at the speed of light. Okay. And we can actually see the existence of the anomaly if we work in the limit where the electric field is weak or negligible. And so that's certainly the easiest way to see the presence of the anomaly. If we want to have a weak electric field in 1D, that's means we have to compactify our theory, because if we have a constant, even if we have a constant but small electric field in 1 plus 1 dimensions, the Coulomb potential is going to grow linearly with distance. So if you separate two charges in a constant electric field in one dimension, the potential, or you have two charges, the potential grows linearly. So this leads to a Coulomb potential. It grows linearly, which leads to strong coupling. Unless we compactify. So we will compactify on a with periodicity L. So that we can remain in the weak coupling regime. And we'll assume that our coupling times L is much less than 1.
V Coulomb. Wait, sorry, Dan. What's between V Coulomb and R?
It's proportional to.
Ah, okay. I thought it
would have been
that.
Sorry. Thank you. Okay, so it will also be convenient to gauge fix. That will help simplify our discussion. So for in periodic space in 1 plus 1 dimensions, in general, our gauge field will be a sum of some time-dependent coefficients times cosine of 2 pi n over lx. Whether it's a sine or cosine will depend on the boundary conditions we impose, but yeah, if you impose periodic boundary conditions to be a cosine, that shouldn't matter too much. we can fix. One thing we can do to fix the gauge is we can do a gauge transformation to eliminate the spatial dependence. In one component of the gauge field. So if we choose so let's suppose we want to set the first component, the spatial component. So to our gauge transformation, A mu goes to A mu plus D mu alpha. And let's suppose we want to set A1 to be a time dependent only, no spatial dependence. We can do that by choosing alpha to be a sum with n not equal to zero of A1 of t sine of t pi n over L x, and I need a L over 2 pi n. So this choice alpha gets rid of the spatial dependence in one component. That's not all we can do to fix the gauge. We're in periodic space. So we need our gauge field to be periodic. There's no such requirement that alpha, our gauge transformation parameter, is periodic. And so we can add an extra term here, which is two pi n over lx. Once we take a derivative of this, x dependence will go to zero, so this is a constant, which obeys our periodicity conditions. So we can use our gauge freedom to set the spatial component of our gauge field to be time dependent, but a spatial constant. But there is still some ambiguity in the, there should be an N here. There's still this residual gauge freedom. This is known as a large gauge transformation. If we set the spatial component of our gauge field to be a spatial constant, there's still a residual gauge freedom of shifting it by 2 pi n over L. And in other words, the spatial component lives on a circle with radius 2 pi over L.
Why is it called a large gauge transformation?
It's not close to the identity. You can't make it. There's no parameter we can set to zero that will set this close to the identity, and that's because alpha is not periodic. So these ones that we can always tune A1, so this goes to zero. But here n has to be an integer. A1 lives on a circle of radius 2 pi over L. And if we're interested, yes.
Sorry, can I explain again why we have to, the coefficient has to be 2 pi n over R? Can it be anything else?
Um, Yes. Yes. Sorry. Sorry. I didn't complete the argument. We also know that the integrals along the spatial direction should be constant, or the integral of we should have the e to the I integral along the spatial direction dx of a1 should be a cusp. This is gauge invariant. So that's where the restriction on the coefficients here comes from. These are Wilson lines, and they're gauge invariants observables. Yes, we haven't discussed these much in our courses yet, but that's where the restriction comes from. Okay. All right, so we're basically ready to find the spectrum. So let's find the spectrum. And again, we're treating psi as quantum and A as classical. We're going to make further restrictions on A. We're going to assume it's classical. We're also going to assume it's slowly varying. And work in this gauge. And I also want to assume that the electric field is small and negligible. And one way to guarantee that is to set the other component to zero. This means that E is negligible. So these two conditions together guarantee that our electric field is unimportant. Okay, so then we want to find the spectrum. We can find the spectrum by solving the Dirac equation. And the solutions, the stationary solutions, will be proportional to e to the I times the energy level, and minus the eigenfunctions, psi n, and periodicity guarantees that these psi n eigenfunctions are like e to 2 pi I n x over L. And that together, that implies that our energy levels, just a little bit of algebra, which I won't do here, of the positive and negative chirality modes are almost the same, just with a shift in sign. They are plus or minus 2 pi n over L minus plus A1. So these are our energy levels. And this is all we'll need to see that this theory has to be anomalous. Any questions so far? So we're just really just simplifying the problem as much as possible to see that to find the spectrum, and that'll be enough to see that there has to be an anomaly here.
You mentioned that the compactification has to do with perturbativeness of whether we can perturb the theory. Is that related to, like, you setting A naught to zero, or?
Yes. So A naught to zero plus periodicity implies that A naught equals zero plus this condition implies that the electric field's small, and together with the periodicity implies that we're in a perturbative regime everywhere. We don't if you have a small electric field in infinite space, if the separation between your particles is large enough, you leave the perturbative regime, the energy grows linearly, the separation.
So we're saying in that case, if we can assume A0 is zero, then?
We could still assume, even if it was not periodic, we could still assume A0 was zero.
But isn't that the Coulomb part of the potential?
But small in infinite space, small e does not imply perturbative. We need periodic space plus small electric field to use perturbation theory.
Okay.
Okay, so let's plot the spectrum. So I'll plot here E versus P. And there's two parts. We have a left moving sector and a right moving sector. So these are massless particles, so they all have E equals P or E equals minus P. Here's the right moving sector, and here's the left moving sector. And so we've just seen that the energy levels are equally spaced, and they depend on A1. So let's first plot the spectrum when A1 is zero. The ground state of the theory in the Dirac C picture. So here we're working in the Dirac C. We'll have all the zero and negative energy states filled. And the positive energy stays empty. And the same thing in the right moving sector. Okay, so let's consider what happens if we make an adiabatic change in A1 from 0 to 2 pi over L. If we change this adiabatically to 2 pi over L, it's an adiabatic change, so our occupation numbers are going to remain unchanged. So what I initially drew is the ground state. And under this adiabatic change, the occupation numbers will remain unchanged. The energy levels will shift. And if we take A1 from 0 to 2 pi over L, the energy levels will shift by exactly 1. But the left and right moving sectors will move in opposite directions due to this sign here. So the Right movers will move down. And the left movers will move up. And so after this change, this one will be filled, or was empty before. And this one will be empty. So we now have a right moving antiparticle and a left moving particle. This adiabatic change has led to pair production. So we have a adiabatic change. And we have a right moving or positive chirality antiparticle. And a left moving particle.
But adiabatic, you mean no change in energy, right?
Yes. So yeah, it's a slow change.
It's a slow change.
Yes, I'm also assuming that this is moving very slowly so that the activation there was some change.
Does the energy change? I mean, the total energy seems to not change since we have pair production, I guess, but is that what happened? Or is it's not about energy, it's just about slowness.
Slowness. I was referring to the slowness here.
Okay.
That's what we need to guarantee that the energy levels won't, occupation numbers won't change.
I'm a bit confused about the plot. So it's the energy versus momentum.
Yes.
And so the momentum of the states are something like 2 pi n over L, right? It's basically, that equation is basically saying En equals Pn plus A1?
That's right.
Okay. In that case, okay.
These are massless particles. So E is equal to plus or minus P, as we're in one spatial dimension. So that's why I've drawn these lines like that. And then the allowed energies are determined by the equation on the far right of that board. So let's consider what happened to the charges after this change. So we have created a right moving antiparticle and a left moving particle. So the electric charge of the antiparticle is minus 1. Electric charge of the particle is plus 1. So the change in the electric charge, or vector charge, is 0. So that is consistent with charge conservation consistent with the vector current being conserved. Now let's consider the axial or chiral charge. So this is a right moving antiparticle. If we assume the right moving particles are the positive chirality particles, a right moving particle would have a chiral charge of plus 1, and a right moving antiparticle would have a chiral charge of minus 1. And a left moving or negative chirality particle will have a charge of minus 1. So chiral charge changes by minus 2. This is not conserved in this process. So just by considering the spectrum and the slow change in our gauge field to particle production and a violation of the chiral symmetry.
Wait, sorry, I missed it. Can you say one more time why left particle chiral charge is minus 1?
Right moving and left moving particles have the same electric charge, but opposite chiral charges. So if the left moving, I'm assuming the right moving particle has chiral charge of plus 1, then the left moving particle and the right moving antiparticle will both have chiral charge of minus 1.
Okay.
And the left moving antiparticle would have charge of plus 1. So we can use.
Wait, just give us the chiral charge. Wait, is chiral charge the same thing as like helicity or chirality?
So the charge is the integral of the associated current. So this charge is the integral of the axial of the vector current. This charge is the integral of the chiral current.
Okay.
We can use this result to guess what the anomalous non-conservation equation looks like. We'll do a more careful derivation tomorrow, but we almost know the answer. So let's try to figure out what the result is. So again, an anomalous non-conservation equation is an equation where the divergence of a current is not zero, but it's something. We want to figure out what that something is. More precisely, this should be an expectation value we discussed before. This is a Ward identity, or would be Ward identity. Okay, so we have shown that if we change A1 by 2 pi over L, we get a change in Q5 minus 2. And if we did a bigger change in A1, we'd also get a bigger change in Q5. So these two are proportional. And we have essentially determined the coefficient of proportionality. And what we want is the rate of change, so dq5 dt, this has to be minus L over pi, just using this result, delta A1 over delta t. Or in other words, q5 dot is minus L over pi A1 dot. Now q5, just referred to as the integral of the zeroth component of J5. We can also write A1 as an integral. So remember, we assumed, or we fixed our gauge so that A1 was a spatial constant. So this L A1 is just the spatial integral of A1. So we also have L A1 is integral dx A1. And this can be written. Here's where some of the guesswork is coming in. Or not. This is not a careful derivation. We'll do that tomorrow. You can also write this as E epsilon 0 mu A0 dx. This is the anti-symmetric symbol. And putting these together gives us combine these, what we have is one component of d mu j mu 5. We don't have any interesting spatial dependence, so all of our spatial derivatives are 0. What we really have is d0, but we can guess what the covariant form of the equation looks like. And that this is 1 over pi epsilon mu nu f mu. So our results are consistent with this. With a little bit of guesswork, you can guess what the form of the anomalous non-conservation equation is, and we'll derive that more carefully tomorrow. So that's our result. And we derive this again, assuming that only our fermionic field was quantum, and we worked just with an entirely classical gauge field. So it had to do just with the fermionic part of the functional integral. And we'll see that tomorrow. When we look at the functional integral, the gauge field part will transform. As you'd expected, we don't have to worry about the transformation of the measure of the gauge field, but the fermionic part transforms non-trivially under a chiral transformation, which is why we have to why we can see this when we're looking at a quantum spinner field, but a classical gauge field. Okay. Now, early in the lecture, I claimed that this had to do with the UV regularization. I'll make a further claim here, is that implicitly, I made a UV regularization somewhere in this derivation. Does anyone see where that entered?
Is it something about like the, I don't know, you ignored some like vacuum energy that's like high energy, I don't know.
You're on the right track, Roger. So yes, we started with the ground state. And then we said I made a statement about how the charge changed after we changed the gate field. What's the charge of the, so if we're talking about a change, we should talk about what the charge was before and after. What's the charge of the ground state? Okay. Minus infinity. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, do you see where the regularization comes in? Exactly. So, yes, you got Saba. So, to compare the charge before or after, we're going to talk about the charge of the ground state. We need to introduce a regulator. Otherwise, we have infinitely many filled states before and after. So it doesn't make sense. We can't compare those in a mathematically rigorous way without introducing a regulator. So implicitly, what I did was I assumed putting a cutting off the spectrum at, say, minus lambda and plus lambda. So if I put that cutoff on my theory, I can say that, well, there's the same number of states in between my cutoffs on the left and the right. So I can say that the initial charge is zero. And I can say what the charge is after we've changed our gauge field. So that's a well-defined with that cutoff. And that cutoff led to a change in the electric charge or vector charge that was zero. Because with this cutoff, every time a state left or moved below this cutoff on the left, another state moved above on the right. So to the two sides of the spectrum we're tied together, and that's also tied together with what's going on at zero. So this is a completely natural way to regularize the theory, but it's not the only way we could do it. We could impose different regulators on the left and the right. We could impose gauge field dependent regulators. And it's possible to choose a regulator. If we chose a regulator that, say, shifted with a gauge field, where the two sides were treated in different ways, where the total change in the chiral charge was zero, and this was non-zero. So these statements strongly depended on our choice of regulator. We made a different choice of regulator, say one that was dependent on the gauge field or treated the left and right in different ways. These results would change. And in general, I could choose a regulator where both currents were not conserved, but there's no choice of regulator that would conserve both currents. And if we want our theory to respect the gauge symmetry, we have to choose that the vector current is conserved. So, we'll examine that more carefully tomorrow when we treat this this problem using functional integrals.
Why is the rate of change of charge proportional to the rate of change of E1?
If I changed A1 from 0 to 4 pi, I would get twice the change in the charges. The energy levels would shift by 2. So delta A1 is proportional to delta Q5, and I just divided by delta T.
I have a question about how you use the variable, because the quantities you're interested in is the
Without introducing a regulator, it's we're comparing two divergent quantities. The charge. It's not, but it. We need to impose a regulator in order to be able to define it in a mathematically consistent way. And for most quantities we've examined throughout the year, it doesn't matter what regulator we use. Here we see our first example where it does. We need to choose a gauge invariant regulator.
So here you have a broken global symmetry, and is there a similar mechanism so that you have a new boson, or because you broke the axial symmetry?
So you're referring to
it's kind of like what like Goldstone boson.
This is not the same. it's true in a sense. Both are ways of breaking a symmetry, but the mechanisms are quite different. So we don't have a boson here.
Usually, the expression for energy has E squared plus V squared, but you have just A one there. How did you get that expression for energy?
That's just from solving the Dirac equation. I have more details in the notes. Yes. I'm happy to continue the discussion afterwards, but I think we should let Mina get ready to talk across.